Thanks to the organizers for both putting together the conference and being conscientious about its environmental impacts. So I'm going to give a talk that's a bit of a reverse of what I would traditionally do. I'm going to start with an application that's extremely concrete that I find appealing, and then kind of go from there with the backstory. So the application won't have anything about cutting and gluing brains, but then we'll see where it came from. Okay. So application. Okay, so let me just introduce and remind you of some standard constructions from Lie theory. Okay, so G is going to be a complex reductive group. And I'll write GC for its maximal compact. So maybe that shows, I guess, that's the distinction between being a mathematician and being a physicist, whether you put the C or the, okay. So, mea culpa. Okay, so, and we'll write G for the Lie algebra. And similarly, GC and so on. Always I'll use this kind of usual frac letter for the Lie algebra. Okay, so let me remind you of the characteristic polynomial construction, characteristic polynomial map. So this is a map, I'll write chi, from the Lie algebra in the form that I'm going to use it to the set of eigenvalues. So I'll write a C, which one can write as H mod W. Okay. So this is the kind of multi-sets of eigenvalues. Okay. So I'll do the example of GLN in a couple of minutes. But let me first just introduce one of the main players that I'll consider. So the nilpotent cone, so N, the nilpotent cone, will just be the inverse image of the distinguished point zero. Okay, so this is a nilpotent cone. Okay, so maybe let me just remind you of what these things look like for the example when G is, say, G is, say, GLN, GLNC. Okay, so then, so these are just n by n invertible matrices. Then G is just all n by n matrices, GLNC, just all n by n matrices. The maximal compact is the unitary matrices. And then this characteristic polynomial map is just the usual one from linear algebra. So chi of a matrix A is just the coefficients of the determinant of 1 minus TA. Okay, and the nilpotent matrices are exactly those with zero eigenvalues. So N equals matrices with zero eigenvalues. Okay, great. Now what I'd like to do is introduce a real form of the group G, which will be distinct from the compact form. Okay, so I'm going to be interested in real groups like GLNR, and so I'd like to introduce just the usual notation and formalism that organizes that picture. Okay, so let's consider now a real form. And I'm going to organize things into a kind of usual diamond that people see in the subject. Okay, so here's the complex group. And inside of it, I have the maximal compact. Okay, and I'm going to put sigma here to denote that we have an involution of G that cuts out GC. Okay, so this is what you would call maybe the Cartan conjugation. Okay. People in the subject tell me that it's very important that you use the right letters here, and I'm not sure if that's right, but okay, I hope. So, but I'm also going to fix extra data, which is a real form GR, okay? And I'll use eta for the conjugation that cuts it out, okay? So once I have these two, I can insist that, well, let me insist from the start that eta and sigma commute, okay? So I will insist that eta and sigma commute, okay, and I'll define a new involution theta to be equal to them. Okay? And then I can look at the fixed points of theta, the involution. So this is now a complex linear involution, and it's typically the fixed points typically denoted by k. And I can simultaneously look at the fixed points of any three, all three of them, or any two of the three, and I see the maximal compact of GR and simultaneously K. Okay, so this is the fixed points of all three conjugations. I mean, all three involutions. Okay. Okay. So the object that I'm going to be interested in some sense is this whole diamond. Okay, so let me now just do the example of GLN. So back to the example. So what I have in mind for GLN is, well, we had UN, and then we can look at GLNR, for example. There are more real forms of GLN, but this is just one example. And the corresponding symmetric subgroup is ONC. Okay, and then the simultaneous intersection of all of these is O, N, R. Okay, and in this case, what do these conjugations do, or what do these involutions do? So eta is just conjugates. Sigma is conjugate transpose inverse. And theta is transpose inverse. Okay. Okay. So so now I'm ready to state a theorem, which I think Olin is one of the favorite. So I don't know what one says. We love all our children equally, or something. Anyway, this is one of my favorite results. So okay. So let me consider. Let me isolate out. Let's focus on two pieces of this picture. Let's focus on eta. Eta, so this is the conjugation. Okay, and then, well, I'll write negative theta because I'm going to be thinking of the Lie algebra. So negative theta on the Lie algebra G. Okay. So this is the conjugation, and this is just a complex linear involution. Okay, and in particular, I want to focus on how they act on the nilpotent cone. Okay, so at the end of the day, what I've done is I've said to any real form, we can pull out of it, naturally pull out of it, two involutive automorphisms of the nilpotent cone. And now I'm going to state a theorem. And this is joint with Cao Xian Chen at Chicago. And the theorem is the following, that there exists a one-parameter family of involutions, one-parameter family of KC equivariant involutions, let's call it delta sigma, going from n to n. Okay, so these are just isomorphisms from n to itself that square to the identity with the following property, so that if we specialize at 0, so maybe let's have, let's make this S inside 0, 1. So if we specialize at 0, we get back eta. And if we specialize at 1, we get back negative theta. Okay. So I like to ponder this for the moment. So what is this saying? It's just saying on the nilpotent cone, there's a way to interpolate between taking the conjugation of a matrix and taking the transpose of a matrix. Okay, so this one is conjugation, and this one is transpose. I put these in quotes because, of course, that's what they are for GLN, but in general, they're something else. Oh, I should have said, let's assume that G is classical. The theorem should be true in all types, but we just haven't checked some of the exceptional types. And do you look puzzled? No, okay. Okay, so so one thing I like about this theorem, maybe I've failed to convey it in making it in this level of generality, is that this is quite a kind of elementary statement. You can either look at the conjugation of nilpotent matrices or the transpose of nilpotent matrices, and there's an interpolating involutions between them. Okay. So let me state a corollary of this, and then that will be, in some sense, the conclusion of the application, and then I'll talk about where this comes from. Okay. So let me state a corollary. So let's just introduce some notation. Let's write, all right, let me state the corollary, and then I'll tell you what it means. So corollary, there exists a KC equivariant homeomorphism between the real nilpotent cone, which by definition will just be the nilpotent cone intersection the fixed points of eta, which is my real subalgebra, and the symmetric nilpotent cone. So I'll write this as P, and I'll write this N intersection P, where, so this one is the eta fixed points, and this one is the negative theta fixed points. Okay, question?
So this one applies to the nilpotent cone and not to the
adapter. Okay, yeah, that's right. So it can't apply, okay, it's false in general. And these involutions do not pass through linear things. I mean, this family is quite geometric as opposed to like algebraic. That's right. So what this does generalize to is we can look at all matrices that have, say, real eigenvalues. And then there's a family of statements of which this is a special fiber. But in general, the eigenvalues of matrices in P don't need to be real. So they won't have anything to do with matrices in here. Okay, but if they're all zero, then that's right. So this is not a statement, that's right. That's a good thing to emphasize in any case. This is not really a statement about the Lie algebras. It's a statement about geometry of the nilpotent cone. Okay, so let me draw one picture of this and then move on to where this comes from, where it came from. Erasers, am I missing? Oh, I see. Is it this one? Yeah.
So is the question, the theorem just for the split form or it's for any real?
No, it's for any, I mean, the only current technical assumption, sorry?
Could you repeat the question?
Oh, sorry. The question was, is it only for the split form or is it for any real form? And the response, what I was going to say is that the only technical assumption for now is that G is a classical group, which I believe will be removed eventually. So that's right. So there's some sort of silly versions of this. So if we, for example, took GR to be GC, okay, then both of these sides would just be zero, would just be a point. Okay, so the content of the statement is maybe greatest when you're more and more split, but there's no requirement. So let me just draw one picture and then talk about where this comes from. So let's do the example of G equals GL2. Okay? So I'm just going to draw the corollary. I don't know how to draw involutions so well, but I'll draw the corollary. So on the one side, on the real side, and R, we just look at the nilpotent cone, which is our favorite quadric, and we just take its real points. Okay, everything is split. There's no kind of twist to the equation. So we see this kind of real quadric cut out by, say, I won't try to be careful about matrices and so on. I'll just write x squared plus y squared equals z squared, okay, in some coordinatization. Okay, so it has point zero, and then it has, well, if you're doing GL2, it has one other orbit, but if you did SL2, it would have two other orbits. In any case, there's a question of the symmetries that depend on the group, but just as far as the geometry of the cone, it's independent of the group. Okay, so this is NR, and now what is NP? So I always get into trouble drawing this, but I'll just draw it like this. So what is NP? NP is given by UV equals zero. Okay, so this is a real picture. So this is a real picture, and this is a complex picture. Okay, so if you go back and you ask what are symmetric 2x2 matrices with zero eigenvalues, okay, what you will find is that they satisfy this something up to a change of coordinates that's UV equals zero. Okay, so this one is they're both real two-dimensional, and they're, I hope, clearly homeomorphic. But I hope it's also apparent that if you're going to write down a homeomorphism, it's not going to be something so obvious. Okay. So this is these two are homeomorphic, and they're, you know, in this case they're homeomorphic via a rotationally equivariant map. Okay. So let me say one before I go on. Let me just say a precursor to this homeomorphism is that Costant. So let me, yeah, maybe I should have said it here. So precursor is what's called the Costant Sekiguchi correspondence. So Costant, I'm told, didn't publish this, but discovered, and then it was also discovered by Sekiguchi, that the orbits of GR here and the orbits of K here are in bijection, that there's a bijection between orbits. So correspondence between, so NR mod GR, so this just means set of orbits, and NP mod K. Okay, so people have known for a long time that these spaces have the same combinatorial shape, I don't know, but it turns out they're actually homeomorphic.
It's going to be an epithelial rotation of some sort.
Okay, very good. Yeah, so the secret here is that it's, I mean, well, okay, so the proof does not, you don't need to know anything about Kähler rotations to give the proof. I will explain the geometry of the proof if I get to it. But people who know the words Kähler rotation see something like this and think Kähler rotation. So that's the right idea, but I can't make that into a technical proof. So at some point I'd be very interested in having a longer discussion about it. I've tried, but I don't see how. Oh, sorry. So the question was, this should be a Kähler, maybe it wasn't, this should be a Kähler rotation. I don't know, the homeo. And the answer is yes, but then there was a kind of a meandering mumbling about, I can't make that into a technical proof, but morally, that's right. So maybe I should say how people understood this. Just a word in response to your question about Kähler rotation. So the way that people understood this in the most kind of enlightened form is that they recognize that these have something to do with Nam's equations. And then they solved Nam's equations and looked at the initial values and matched them up. Okay, so that's a proof of the bijection, but Nam's equations are very, very singular. I mean, well, the spaces are singular, and the solutions to Nam's equations kind of give you SL2 triples, but not some more geometry. So you'll see hyper-Kähler rotation when it comes, but I don't, okay, yeah, so I won't use anything technical about it. Okay, so that's, sorry, I started it when? I started at like 12:15 or 12:10, okay, so, and it's an hour talk, right? Okay, great. So, okay, so that's motivation for what I'm going to talk about. All right, so that's the, and what did I do? I lost the eraser again.
No, here.
Okay. Okay, so part two of my talk. Okay, so now you can forget this for now if you like, but it'll come at the end. We'll return to this. Okay, so part two of my talk will be a very natural kind of continuation or alternative perspective on Jürg's talk. Okay, so it's kind of well scheduled in that what I'd like to talk about as a kind of theoretical framework to get to a result like this, I'd like to talk about what I like to call Betti geometric Langmuir. Betti geometric Langlands. Okay, so Jörg already explained a lot of what I could say to you. So I'll try to give you the most succinct version of what I mean by this, just to orient you within the context he set up. And then we'll talk about some specific geometry that will arrive us back here. Okay. So let me just remind you of the kind of rough analogy that I have in mind, or that one might have in mind here, is, okay, so there's something called Dirac geometric Langlands. All right, it's typically called geometric Langlands, but I'm going to specify that we call it Dirac geometric Langlands. This is, I hope, what people are viewing as a CFT. And then there's Betti geometric Langlands, which I'll make a precise conjecture. Geometric Langlands, I'll make a precise conjecture in a moment, which is a kind of version that one hopes will be a TFT. Okay, so that's just to orient you with what I mean by Betti. On the spectral side, let me just say, the adjectives are exactly the kind of connections we will take. Okay, so the adjectives match the connections or local systems, I don't know. So Dirac means flat connection, and Betti means representation of pi 1. Okay, so now let me state a kind of very rough version of the Betti-Langlands conjecture. And then I'll try to motivate why one might think about it, although Jörg already did a really good job in explaining that there are structures that, I'm running out of chalk. There are structures that one sees that naturally fit into topological theory. Okay, so the rough conjecture is the following. So again, I'll view it as an example of 2D mirror symmetry, but of course what you'll see as the talk goes on, much of what I'm interested comes from higher dimensions. Okay, so let me state it as a kind of version of, so this is like kind of 2D mirror symmetry conjecture part of the story. So we have an A side, and we have a B side. Okay. So the B side is going to be coherent sheaves on local systems for G check. Oh, I should say, all right, so X is a smooth projective curve over C. Okay, so local systems on X. Okay, now we can decide to decorate this. We can put IND here, we can put singular support conditions. Let me not do any of that decoration, because I actually believe there will be a version literally for this category. I mean, the decorations have to do with specifying certain things, and this is kind of as fundamental as any of the decorations. Okay, now what goes on the automorphic side? So let me morally let me give you the answer, and then I'll discuss morally. So the answer that we propose is you look at sheaves on bungee of X, and here you specify nilpotent singular support. So unlike Jörg's talk, where he decided to focus on, say, nilpotent singular support here and ignore the singular support of D modules, I'm going to ignore the singular support of O modules and focus on the singular support of D modules, because technically a lot of theorems depend on this adjective. Okay, so this is nilpotent singular support. Okay, so the zero fiber of the Hitchin system. Okay, so this is the rough form of the conjecture. And let me.
What does SH mean?
Okay, yeah. So SH alone just means topological sheaves. So sheaves of, say, complex vector spaces on this stack. Okay, so this is a moduli space. To every open, I can assign some complex without any worries about coherence or anything like this. You know, maybe we need to put some bounds on sizes and stuff. Let me not worry about that. What you might typically do is say, okay, I want them to be constructible with respect to a stratification. I'm not doing that. Instead, I'm saying they're microlocally constructible, meaning that their microlocal behavior is controlled by this Lagrangian. Okay? So both sides are sheaves, okay, but just of different ilk.
Okay?
Yeah, so what's the, all right, so first this has relations, this has relations to two other objects that one sees all the time, okay? So this, excuse me, has a map from, if you look at, you can look at D modules, okay, D modules on bungee X, and now we can insist that they be regular, so I don't know, I'll decorate, so regular, no, D regular modules, and then moreover, I can insist that their singular support lies in N. So I don't know where to decorate it, N, okay? Okay, oh, sorry.
Sorry.
The question is, where does D modules fit into this? Or what am I, yeah, how does this relate to D modules? And my answer is that there's a map, a kind of usual Riemann-Hilbert, or taking solutions, takes D modules with that are regular, they're holonomic because N is Lagrangian, and maps them to here, okay? And this is fully faithful, okay? But there are all sorts of big sheaves here that are not given by D modules. Okay, so I'd be happy to do an example, but I fear I'll run out of time, so maybe just after I'll do any kind of example you like. The point is, I don't particularly like giant sheaves, except some things like the structure sheaf here go to very big sheaves.
But these sheaves have local mention, so they're locally constant.
They're stratified locally constant. I mean, they're locally constant in the same sense that D modules are locally constant. That's right, yeah. These you should think of as solutions to these, yeah. I want to make, all right, so this is sort of almost an equivalence. So this almost equivalence means that if you look at only objects that are small enough, then it'll be an equivalence, okay? This is I should say this is an analog of, if you look at the moduli of Durham connections or local systems, they're analytically, they look the same. So anything that's small enough, like skyscraper sheaves, you can't tell which world you're in, okay? So if these two are, if you're only studying small things that are, say, proper support on the spectral side, then you can't tell which world you're in.
So roughly they're local systems on bungee. No.
Yeah, I mean local systems where, that's right, roughly speaking, they're local systems on bungee. That's right, if you're asking like what kind of sheaf they are, that's right, that's the right kind of taxonomy. I don't know. Sorry, the question was, are they roughly local systems on bungee? Okay. But I think they're all asleep. It looks like dusk, and I don't know.
It's just dark for the video.
I see. Yes, question.
Do you know the image?
Okay, so the question was, do you know the image? And yes, I mean, the image are the ones here that are, have.
Sorry,
yeah, I mean, the conjectural image here will be things with proper support, something like this. I mean, you see, anything where these two are the same must correspond to there being no distinction between Durham and Betty. So, okay, so let me make one more comment apropos of Jurg's talk about this category. So there's also, let me put here a kind of equivalence in quotes. Okay, so there's also an equivalence in quotes between this and the wrapped Fukaya category of the Hitchin system. So I guess M G, X, okay? So this isomorphism is in quotes not because it shouldn't be true on the nose, but because it's still being developed by the community. So this is kind of in progress, and I'd be happy to report on that. It's not my work alone. It's a huge endeavor by lots and lots of people to see that, roughly speaking, the theory, the microlocal theory of sheaves and the theory of Lagrangian brains is the same. Okay, so this is a kind of community project that I'm happy to talk about, but won't talk about now. Okay, so from Jurg's talk, I guess we're kind of squarely in the setting that he suggested, which is that we're studying the Fukaya category of the Hitchin system, and that's the thing we expect to be the TFT, but instead we're going to mathematically replace it by sheaves with nilpotent singular support. Okay, so this has a kind of very beautiful formal theory that this has still in development. Okay? Okay, so that's kind of where we are with what I mean by Betty and so on. Okay, so let me state then the first conjecture of this story. So the first conjecture, well, let me state first theorem and then conjecture. Okay. So, So the first theorem that I want to state is a theorem due to David Ben-Zvi, myself, and Tolly Pragel. And it says that the right-hand side, the B-side, is indeed a TFT. Okay? So the B-side, as we've stated it, B-side is a TFT. Okay, so I'm not going to go into details. Like one thing I could talk about is what do we assign to the circle in this TFT? Okay, so let me not go into details, but let me just tell you that what you assign to the circle is what you might call 2-co of G check mod G check. Sort of exactly what you would expect. You assign, you look at local systems on the circle, and then you assign some B model thing called 2-co, which, okay, I don't want to get into what it is, but one concrete realization of this is that you can say that this is the same thing as module categories for the affine Hecking category. Okay, so there's many other kind of ways to think about this. Okay, so this theory is associated to this monoidal category. This monoidal categories modules, this theory is associated. Okay, so the main point of this slide, so to speak, is not to convey anything other than that the B side is topological. So of course then one makes the conjecture that the A side is topological.
So is it possible there is a for BTFT?
Okay, yeah, we can talk about different, at minimum, I say that it doesn't depend on the modulus of X, okay? At maximum, I say there's a fully extended TFT and so on. So let me just let you interpret what you mean. Sorry, the question was, what do you mean by topological? And I said, I'm happy to have you interpret it either from the any extreme. Even the local constancy in X is difficult and beyond current understanding, okay? So let me just maybe give evidence, so let me collect some evidence for this conjecture, okay? But yeah, that's right, even the minimal version of this conjecture is already an interesting conjecture. So let me say one reason why it's already an interesting conjecture is from some perspective we expect as we move the curve that the Hitchin system as a symplectic manifold is just moving through what you might call Liouville isotopies. Like it's not actually changing in a way that should affect the brains. Okay? So if we had an approach to this A side that was truly symplectic, then this conjecture should either be like eminently true or like false for an obvious reason. Okay? So on the one hand, once the community in progress establishes that this is equivalent to the Rafukai category, then it should be obvious that this is independent of the curve. But on the other hand, if you write things as sheaves with nilpotent singular support, the nilpotent singular support is changing quite dramatically as one moves over the moduli of curves, and so it's not clear at all that this category is locally constant. Okay? So it's either a hard technical conjecture or a consequence of some better conceptual picture of what's going on. Okay? All right, but let me tell you some kind of mathematical evidence for this without assuming that the community in progress result will kind of converge. Maybe I'll do this. Okay, so some evidence. Okay, so evidence for the conjecture. Okay, so on the one hand, let me say it's already interesting in genus zero. And what do I mean by that? Well, of course, there's only one genus zero curve, P1, but that P1 has symmetries, okay? And this is a well-known, I don't want to try to ascribe who I should ascribe things to, but there's well-known, PGL2C symmetries that one sees on all of these categories, okay? So the mapping class group, so to speak, the symmetries here are part of an important story, okay? Genus 1 is the first place where we actually have moduli, where it actually, it's possible that there could be some reason that this category is not topological. And this is a theorem of Penghui Li and myself that that it's independent. So the A side is independent of the modulus. Okay, so it's not, I don't say that this is convincing, but at least it's the first thing that could go wrong. So, okay, and now let me tell you a more kind of critical or, I don't know, structurally convincing theorem. So this is a theorem, myself and Jiwei Yun, which says that the Hecke or Etouffe operators, so Ben has taught me I should write this, is that right? Okay. I hope, or Etouffe operators, I'll draw a picture in a second, so the line operators are topological, okay, are topological. So let me draw a picture of what I mean by this, so you can see. So the picture, so here's our Riemann surface, okay? And so there's a third dimension now that we're discussing that has nothing to do with the, you know, it's not built into the two dimensions we've already been discussing. So the third dimension allows us to look at, in four dimensions, line insertions. So I can look at a point of the curve and then remove a point and travel through to the other side, and so I see these local operators. And you can ask, how does this vary as I take this point around the curve? I mean, I don't know. Does this operator depend locally constant on the parameter of this point? And this theorem is telling you yes, okay? So this theorem, the main content is that when you insist on nilpotent singular support, this holds, okay? So the proof is use nilpotent singular support. Okay? So if you just looked at all sheaves or all D-modules or, I don't know, any version of these things that does not prescribe that brains are living in some sense along this vacuum fiber, this would not be true. Question?
You see, Lin, there, you really mean constructed from brains that live there, deformed
right.
In the neighborhood.
Okay, so the question was, are you only thinking about brains living along this fiber, or are you only using, but you really should mean brains that can be constructed from ones living along that fiber. And I don't make that distinction. I mean, everything is kind of, the whole space has a kind of contraction to being near that fiber. So in some sense, it doesn't make sense. But I just want to emphasize that this is really where one sees this seriously. So unlike in Jürg's talk, where we're not going to consider this because we're going to only consider irreducible objects, here we want to study the entire category. I'm aiming to study the entire category. And in order to see that topological structure of the entire category, I need to insist on this. Okay, that's what that theorem is telling you. Okay, let me state a corollary then, which a kind of formal corollary of the theorem, which at least gives you a sense of where such an equivalence can come from. So once one proves that theorem, it's a formal consequence that if one looks at the spectral side and considers perfect complexes now instead of coherence, so just vector bundles, because I want to tensor them, that this, equipped with tensor, acts on the automorphic side. Okay, so this is a kind of formal, once one, maybe this is, I say it's formal, but this is a conference in higher algebra. So this is a moment where higher algebra comes in. So once you know that all of your operators over finite subsets of the curve behave topologically, you can integrate them, and the integral is this, okay? So it's a formal consequence of kind of chiral or factorization homology type constructions that you get this kind of an action, okay? Okay, so I'd like to take this as a kind of hopeful starting point and then suggest to you that there's a kind of better starting point in some sense, okay? So once one has an action, one feels like, okay, I'm very close to being home because everything here is generated by acting on the structure sheaf by other things. So I should just figure out the sheaf that corresponds to the structure sheaf, act on it, and I'm done. Right? That's kind of an obvious philosophy. Once you have an action, the whole content is in some sense showing this is like a rank one free module. So let me just pick a generator, act on it, and be done. Okay, so let me suggest what happens if you try to do that. Okay, this is old theory. Like, people in the subject know very well this kind of point of view. I should say it's a different, this is very much like a representation theorist's point of view rather than a mirror symmetry theorist's point of view. So mirror symmetry, you have these dual abelian vibrations, is a very beautiful starting point. Here we're starting with the Hecke symmetries as the kind of reason we believe Langlands. Okay, so let me sort of give you a naive construction, just what I said, naive construction of a functor going from, say, B side to A side. So what should I do? Well, the elders teach us that the structure sheaf O of the spectral side should go to a certain object. If you understand this kind of Oper's point of view, it should go to a certain object called the Whitaker sheaf. Okay, so let me just write WHG, and I'm not going to define it, but let me just say we can talk about the Whitaker sheaf. Okay, so this is some object that's like quantization of Oper's now on the automorphic side. And so you should just act on the Whitaker sheaf. So now, act on the Whitaker sheaf using the corollary. Okay. So let me tell you the good news and the bad news. Sorry, question? No? Okay, so let me tell you the good, is it clear what I'm suggesting? Okay, so there's good news. So good news is not hard to come by, which is that you understand something very beautiful about this functor constructed this way, which is that the structure sheaf goes to the Whitaker sheaf. Okay, you built that into the story, okay? So O goes to W. Good news, okay? Like, it would be, it's possible that, you had no idea where it went. Okay, so that's very good, but now there's some challenge. I don't know, bad news or challenge? I don't know. I should say this is the right functor. It's just a question of, what are you going to be able to prove about this functor? So the challenge is on the spectral side, so let me write... Let me write this more matching so that I have more objects to consider. Okay, so this goes to Whitaker of G. Now, on the spectral side, we can look at induced brains as well. So the most common thing to look at is local systems. I'll write the structure sheaf of B check local systems. So I'm looking at local systems that come by induction from a torus. Okay? And now I can apply my functor to them. Why not? Okay, I have a functor. And the answer that you expect is that this goes to Eisenstein series for B. If it doesn't, something's gone wrong. You expect it to go there, but you have no idea. Okay? When I say you have no idea, you don't have an apparent method of proof. Thank you. You don't have an apparent method to prove it based on what you've done so far. I should say, I don't see any apparent method of proof, okay? So in some sense, I've thought about this a long time, and if anyone has any comments, I'd love to have them, but I don't see a way to proceed that's so easy in this case, okay? Let me just say, the natural things to pair, the natural kinds of brains to pair are things like vector bundles and coherent sheaves. It's very difficult to pair like a vector bundle with a vector bundle, or a coherent sheaf with a coherent sheaf. So somehow to make calculations, you want to have things that look like vector bundles and things that look like coherent sheaves, and you want to be able to pair them together. So if you don't have both of these classes of objects, it's very difficult to get anywhere. Andy, you look... No, okay. Okay, so that brings me to the third part of the talk, which is to talk about cutting and gluing brains. Okay, so I like to propose an alternative functor that resolves this problem. I've tried to convince you this is a problem. Whether or not you bought it or not, that's up to you. But in any case, I tried to give you a kind of alternative path that turns out to be very productive. Okay, so cutting, gluing, brains. Okay, so what I'd like to do now is the usual kind of Verlinda game. I don't know whether it's, or TFT, I mean, yeah. So now I'm doing something that, what do you say, bringing coals to Newcastle. Okay, so locals know very well that these theories come from higher dimensions, and so we should try to cut up the curve as well, okay? So I want to do a kind of higher Verlinda formula. Maybe it's user error with the chalk. Okay, higher Verlinda formula. I want to calculate, you know, this, or maybe I should write a side of this kind of thing in terms of, you know, a side of this kind of thing, you know, and other kinds of things like that. Okay? So, okay, so let me explain a kind of beautiful piece of geometry available to you, okay? So let me say the available geometry. So we can degenerate our curve to a nodal curve at the boundary, okay? So degenerate x to nodal at zero. Okay, so let me draw a local picture of what happens. So here's a piece of x. I don't know, x is continuing off somewhere else. And now I degenerate this, and I pick up a node here. Okay, so the rest of x is just along for the ride, okay? All right, so here's my first kind of degeneration. Now, if you were a homotopy theorist and you thought of this as a map, you could then form the entire pushout diagram of this map. And what you would find is kind of pictures like this, and so on. So of course, these pictures are just what happens when you take multiple curves and start degenerating. Okay? So there's an entire diagram available to you. There's a kind of augmented diagram of degenerations. Okay. And now the main conjecture is that under nearby cycles, this should be a limit diagram. So main conjecture. So we should get a limit diagram.
Yeah, I have a question.
Please.
Yeah. The notation is makes it look like it's a completional object. Is that?
That's right. It should look exactly like a augmented cosimplicial object.
Oh yeah, cosimplicial. So is it genuinely cosimplicial, or is it homotopy cosimplicial?
Well, it depends on what you're asking about. If you're, I mean, these aren't even maps. these are degenerations.
I see.
So there is a honest cosimplicial diagram of degenerations of which I'm extracting fibers from that honest diagram. So let me not, I don't think it's worth explaining that technically, but what I hope to convey to you is that if you start with this map, think of this as a map, and then take pushouts, that you would develop something that looks exactly like the like higher degenerations, okay, as a cosimplicial diagram, or semi-cosimplicial. I don't know. Look happy? I think so. Okay. Okay. So the main conjecture is that we get a limit diagram by passing. Well, let me just write what we do. We take sheaves with nilpotent support on x, and then we take nearby cycles. So this is nearby cycles. Two sheaves with nilpotent singular support on x0, and so on. Okay? Okay, so once we have this diagram of degenerations, one can just try to take the limits of brains as we go to the boundary, and the hope would be that this is a limit diagram. Okay. So that would mean, if it's a limit diagram, that we can calculate the generic category in terms of pieces that presumably we have a chance of understanding. Okay, so let me just give you some. All right, so this main conjecture is wide open. I mean, I can tell you, even to tell you that I have here a cosimplicial category is challenging. I mean, I don't have a general proof. Okay, so even to see that nearby cycles commute is already a serious piece of business. Okay, and I should say also, I don't know. The other conjecture I stated, maybe, that one maybe you have some motivation for from TFT, that you see that if you have a completely symplectic definition, that you should have no problem proving that. Here, even if you have a symplectic definition, there still is going to be serious geometry involved in understanding this. Okay. So let me state just some evidence in the form of a theorem. So this is a theorem with Ben-Zvi and Pongwei-Li. That this is true in genus 1. So, true in genus 1. Okay, so in genus 1, I told you we already had, but we already knew that it was locally constant over the moduli of elliptic curves. So even going to the boundary made sense. And then you can check that this holds. Okay, maybe I should be careful and say maybe G is adjoint. I don't remember if that's necessary for this statement. So let's assume, just for safety, that G is adjoint. Okay. All right. So I'm almost. I have about 10 more minutes. Is that right? Yeah. Okay. So So this theorem, coupled with our understanding of these categories in genus 0, you can derive as a corollary that this Betti geometric Langlands conjecture in genus 1. Okay, so it's a calculation. You can reinterpret this all as just saying, okay, you've calculated the Hochschild homology of the affine Hecke category. That's one kind of succinct way to say this. Okay, so let me state another, as evidence of that good things are happening, let me state another theorem, and then I'm going to go back to the application at the beginning. Okay, so another theorem that gives you evidence that good things are happening, joint work with Yun. I didn't write down which archive papers things are on. So, okay, so now let's look at the adjoint to this. Okay, so now we're doing higher algebra. I don't know. Okay, so now we're going to look at the adjoint to this. And I want to state two properties that this adjoint has that I conveyed to you would be valuable. So the first one is that if I take the Whitaker sheaf, that it takes it not to the Whitaker sheaf, but to W copies, the Weyl group. So this is the Weyl group. W copies of the Whitaker sheaf. Okay? And the second is that it takes the Eisenstein sheaf to Eisenstein sheaves of appropriate twists and so on. Okay? So whether or not you can calculate things, this functor has form. I mean, this theorem is not difficult to prove. Okay? So it means that if you're going to try to write down a transform from the B side to the A side, this approach is correct, but this approach may be easier to work with. And in fact, like proving this kind of thing is because we understand these formal properties. Okay. So that's kind of where my understanding, this was a summary of where my understanding of various things in Betti geometric Langlands stand. There are all sorts of cases that are really beautiful and interesting where I understand some of these conjectures, but I just picked the kind of easiest ones to say. I mean, the ones that kind of use the fewest words. But I'd be happy to talk to people about, questions in other cases.
Maybe missing something obvious on this blog. So was there a similar statement on the B side, which is obviously true?
Yeah, okay, so the question was, I might be missing something here. Was there a similar statement on the B side that was like this? And the answer is yes. It's buried somewhere in the beginning of the talk. So I told you that the B side forms a TFT. And at some, I meant that in a very strong sense, that you could actually cut the Riemann surfaces and glue, and you will find these properties hold for the structure sheaf of local systems and for the structure sheaf of Weizen. Yeah, so these are, of course, one only guessed these based on the B side. That's right. Okay, so now I'm going to just spend 5 more minutes going back to the application. So I'd like to explain to you how this idea of looking at Betti geometric Langlands, these moduli spaces, and degenerating to the boundary leads to a proof of the application I stated at the beginning. Okay, and I hope I just will spend 5 minutes. Okay. Oh. Oh, that's a. Oh, it's this one. Yeah. Okay. Oh, I got confused. Okay. Okay, so back to application. Okay, so you, in fact, I won't use any categories or higher algebra. I don't know. I will use just the moduli spaces involved in our discussion. So if I lost you somewhere in the last half hour, you can give it a shot if you want to come back, because I'm not going to use anything about sheaves or anything like this. Okay, so the key observation that I want to make is that this Betti geometric Langlands makes sense for real groups on non-oriented surfaces. Okay, so real groups on non-oriented surfaces. Okay, so let me tell you what I mean, just what is the A-side moduli. A side moduli. Okay, so now what do I give myself? I give myself my x again, but now x comes with a conjugation. Okay? And g, we knew, already came with a conjugation called eta? I don't remember. Conjugation. Okay? So between these two, we can construct a conjugation on bun g of x. Okay, I don't know, call it theta sub, eta sub alpha. Okay, so this induces a conjugation of bun g of x, and now I can pass to real points, which is a topological stack. Okay, so let's consider the real points, bun g x, and I'll denote it like this. Okay, and I'm going to consider this as a topological stack. Okay, so the point is I can still consider topological sheaves, vector bundles with flat connection, and I can still consider nilpotent singular support on this real stack. Okay, so I'm not going to go in that direction for now. Okay, so yeah, if you think about what kind of Galois descent tells you, you're basically looking at G bundles on the quotient of x by alpha. That's why I say it's kind of non-orientable. So the non-orientable surface is x mod alpha. Okay? And as you move around, you twist and you re-glue using this symmetry. Okay, so I'd like to see what this moduli space looks like in the simplest case. Okay? So let me describe what this moduli space looks like in the absolute simplest case. And then I'll be done. Okay, so simplest case, let's take x to be P1, just usual CP1, and alpha to be complex conjugation. I don't know, local coordinate goes to z bar. Okay? So if you like, x mod alpha is a disk. Okay? So it's like we're doing geometric Langlands for a real group on a disk. Okay? Okay, and now let's uniformize our moduli space. Okay, so our moduli space, we're going to uniformize bun g x r. Okay? Now, what do I mean by uniformize? I'm going to trivialize my bundles away from some locus and then describe the bundles in terms of data, gauge gluings at the locus. Okay? So the most naive thing I can do is I can take my P1. Okay, I don't know. I draw the real points as going like this. I don't know why. Okay, so like here's 0 and so on. Okay, so I take P1 and I pick two conjugate points in color, maybe. So I pick two conjugate points, say I and minus I, okay, and I trivialize my bundles away from those two points. Okay? And what you find if you do this is you find a copy of the affine Grassmannian, that's the kind of gluing data at one or the other point, modulo the loops in the real group. Okay? So if you just go and you uniformize your moduli using this open, you will find this space, this presentation. Okay. And now what I can do, though, is I can degenerate the two points and make them real. Okay. So I can send the two points to 0. Okay. So this is degenerate the points. Okay. 1 minute? Okay. I can degenerate the points. Okay. And what do I see when I degenerate the points? Then the gluing data is the real Grassmannian, modulo KC. I'm just going to tell you the answers. Okay, so this moduli degenerates to something that looks like this. And on the other hand, I can do what we've been discussing up to now, which is degenerate the curve. Okay, so degenerate the curve. Okay, but keeping the points still here. Okay, and now what I see is I see a copy of the Grassmannian, but I see modulo kind of arcs in K. Okay? The last thing I'll write is just that this naturally contains a copy of the real nilpotent cone, and this naturally contains a copy of the symmetric nilpotent cone. Okay? So this is some kind of form of hyperkähler rotation. I mean, I can say more about that, but in any case, the place that technically the proof of the original application comes from is from these kinds of degenerations of moduli spaces. Okay, thank you.
So, as usual, we first want to encourage the overseas audience to ask any questions.
I didn't. Is he bringing him a microphone?
Sorry, we missed the question.
Can you translate, or I don't know?
Maybe since you're the one with the microphone, you should tell them that.
Oh, I'm sorry. We can't understand the question. So maybe Andre could ask the question or repeat the question.
Oh.
I think we understand when Andre speaks. Is that right?
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, good. So when you were thinking about why the B side was a topological field theory, you state the value on the circle should be in terms like two coherent sheaves. Right. There should be a lot of structure to the thing you state to the circle, like in particular a braiding and other structure. Can you see that?
Yes. I mean, So the question, I hope everyone heard the question, was in this, on the B side, if you assign to a circle something you call two coherent sheaves, it should have a braiding and so on. Can you see that? So one answer to that is that you just need to know that that theory has enough functoriality to take in the usual correspondences that one sees coming from the fact that you took local systems on a circle. So local systems on a circle have a lot of nonlinear geometry, pairs of pants and so on, which give you braidings. And so you need to check that whatever this two-co business is, that they admit enough pullbacks and push forwards for that to go through. So I don't want to explain that. It's very nice. It's a kind of, it's a kind of micro-local theory. It's another place where symplectic geometry enters. So the answer is roughly yes, but not a very satisfying yes.
Any further questions?
Maybe I could also just say that there is something that one could also call 3-co of BG check. So BG check is both smooth and has smooth diagonal, and it makes sense to consider something called 3-co for that, which has even more structure. So in fact, you can go all the way down to a point. That's not written anywhere, so I won't send you to a reference, but.
Any further questions from either audience? No? Then we should thank David.
Sorry,
so there is a question. Sorry.
You bring the microphone, please. Oh, I see.
Hello.
Hi. Yeah, just be glad.
Hey, well, in your discussion between brains at the higher political scale, you seem to be allowing the generation also into non-stable curves. Was what your picture and the decay. However, of course, in the usual relative stuff, you would only degenerate into curves like degenerations you consider dealing non-form application. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, so all right, so the question is, as I understood it, but correct me if I didn't understand, is that I wasn't stipulating that the curves we consider were stable. That I, for example, consider genus 0, genus 1, without introducing any marked points, and degenerated, and so on. And so usually there's a Dillean-Mumford compactification for the moduli of stable curves. And I should say that, yeah, I don't require that. I'm happy to work over the entire moduli space. I think maybe the advantage to working with stable curves is that you've cut down the automorphisms to finite groups. But if you don't mind having further automorphisms, and they're typically only kind of helpful, then I don't think there's any reason to insist on stable curves.
Any further questions? Then we should thank David again.